different cause areas can have 10x or even 100x differences in potential impact for philanthropists. And so cause prioritization can be some of the most important decisions, if not the most important decision that a philanthropist makes. I hope that being transparent in this way opens us up to scrutiny.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, if you want to do good and you do not have unlimited funds, how do you choose which places, people, situations are most deserving? Do you invest in economic benefits or do you invest in lives saved? Open Philanthropy is an organization that aims to optimize the impact of every dollar it spends, and it doesn't focus on one region or one type of intervention, so it makes these choices every day. Emily Olson, MD of Open Philanthropy, joins me today, and she's going to explain the eye-opening method that it uses to make grants in its global health and well-being portfolio. I guarantee this is going to challenge you to think. Maybe you might disagree as well. Emily, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily, first of all, tell me about Open Philanthropy. What is it? Who are you?
Open Philanthropy is my employer and also a grant-making organization that aims to maximize our impact. Many grant-makers do this within cause areas, but Open Phil is unusual because we are cause neutral. So we work from the ground up to try to find the most promising causes that we can, rather than starting with a fixed list that's driven by donor preferences or personal ties from people on staff.
So how big and how diverse does this make your portfolio?
I lead our work in what we call our global health and well-being portfolio, and we currently give away several hundred million dollars per year across roughly four categories. So the first is that we support health interventions in low and middle income countries through an organization called GiveWell. This includes things like mosquito nets to stop malaria, vaccines, vitamin supplements, and chlorine dispensers that make water safe to drink. The second area is we support scientific research and development with the focus on health. So trying to create new tools and to improve the tools that we already have to diagnose, prevent, and treat neglected diseases that affect and kill millions of people every year in low and middle income countries. The third is a bit of a catch-all. We have a number of smaller programs that focus on saving lives and increasing global prosperity in leveraged ways, often through policy advocacy. So an example, which we may talk about later, is we have a growing program that tries to address widespread lead exposure that exists globally. And then the fourth is that we try to curb the worst abuses of factory farming around the world.
You are very unusual. The reason we're talking to you is you are so unusual because you do not commit to a cause or a region. Why not?
Great question. So our approach has evolved organically over the last decade. So to give a little bit of background, in 2006, two people, Ellie Hassenfeld and Holden Karnowski, founded an organization called GiveWell. They were first and foremost trying to build a product for themselves that answered the question, okay, we want to give away some of our salaries to charity every year. How can we know what those contributions are doing in the world? And how can we get the most bang for our buck? And so they started researching charities and exploring ways to compare and measure return on investment of different philanthropic opportunities. And they shared their results online. More and more people over time got interested. And GiveWell has continued to build up support. And now they're guiding hundreds of millions of dollars in donations every year. In 2010, so relatively early on, two people, Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz, approached GiveWell with a slightly different question than the one that Holden and Ellie started with. So they had billions of dollars to give away. They were interested in doing as much good as they could with it. Unlike a lot of wealthy donors, they didn't have a specific cause area in mind. They were open to almost anything. And so they wanted to continue their support of GiveWell, as well as to support work aimed at the same goals, but they were okay with opportunities that had greater uncertainty or couldn't be measured as clearly as some of GiveWell's top interventions. And so Open Philanthropy was born from those conversations. It began as a subset of GiveWell called GiveWell Labs, and then it spun out in 2017 to become its own organization. So from the very start, we had this kind of blue sky approach to how to best help others and what areas to work in. And so that has caused both OpenPhil and GiveWell to invest a lot in what we call cause prioritization. So these research teams that are dedicated to the question of what causes should we work on to maximize impact. And this whole function is pretty rare in philanthropy. So we're really lucky to be able to ask these big picture questions and follow the impact wherever it leads.
So that's the supply, which is substantial, but the demand, because you don't limit where you get involved, is limitless, isn't it?
Yeah. So We hope over time, like more and more people demand this kind of research and are interested in cause prioritization. Historically, OpenPhil has been focused on finding enough outstanding giving opportunities to hit Dustin and Carrie's spending targets. Mm-hmm. But we've had this long-term vision that once we hit those targets, which we've gotten a lot closer to over the last couple of years, that we could expand our work to support other donors who are interested in this style of giving as well.
Other organizations, as I've already said, commit to a particular field of specialization. It's pretty hard. We've spoken to some of them. It's pretty hard for them to work out where their money could be best employed. Is your job much harder than theirs?
Good question. I wouldn't say harder. I think prioritizing across causes and prioritizing within causes are both very challenging. But what I would say instead is that choosing fields of specialization is really important. So different cause areas can have 10x or even 100x differences in potential impact for philanthropists. And so cause prioritization can be some of the most important decisions, if not the most important decision that a philanthropist makes.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about how you make those decisions about where you decide to act in a second. Okay, Emily, now you have two frameworks for how you decide to allocate your resources. The first one is to equalize the marginal returns for grant making. This sounds like the principle that I learned in economics as an undergraduate, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yes, the idea is very simple. And anyone who's been in an undergraduate economics course, I think will be familiar with it. But we're just trying to apply this very basic idea from economics to philanthropic giving. So in short, what we're trying to do is translate the benefits of potential grant making into a single unit. We then select the highest impact per dollar areas and fund them to the point of equalized marginal benefits. So if we have an additional dollar and it can generate more benefits in one cause area versus another, we'll reallocate. And we do that iteratively over time. And that leads us to a place where we have cause areas that have different budgets, but similar marginal benefits and what we think is an optimized overall portfolio.
Yeah, give me a for example of this, an area where there might be a project with a high marginal benefit and one with a much lower marginal benefit.
So I'll start with a high marginal benefit. So we've been thinking, I mentioned earlier, a lot about global lead exposure recently, mm-hmm. which is an enormous problem. One example is in Bangladesh. Until quite recently, a major source of lead poisoning came from the use of lead chromate in brightening the cooking spice turmeric. So people would add lead to turmeric to change its coloring. Uh-huh. And this was identified by a group of researchers at Stanford University and then a Bangladeshi nonprofit organization called ICDDRB. And they went ahead and they tested samples in markets and then advocated for compliance among suppliers. So with the government of Bangladesh, they were able to significantly decrease contamination. They did a survey in 2019 of turmeric, and they found that at that time, 47% of samples had lead contamination. And then when they did that same survey in 2021, so 2 years later, that number had dropped to zero, which is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to do a really rough approximation of the number of lives that will be saved over the next 5 years as a result of this change. And our best guess is 20,000. Wow. And since the research and advocacy leading to that change costs several million dollars, that's a cost of several hundred dollars per life save. Mm-hmm. And so just to reiterate, that estimate is super rough. We have a lot of uncertainty around it, but it's a remarkable amount of change. And so I think maybe taking a step back, like I don't have a specific example in mind for a low return activity, but a general observation is that there's a lot of really cheaply preventable suffering in the world. So the Bangladeshi lead example is unusual for us. It's one of the most cost-effective opportunities that we've seen. But there are many really reliable ways to save lives in expectation for several thousand dollars. And so that's what we think about as the bar for high marginal return activities.
That project is sort of an outlier because it's so extreme. Even if you are out by a factor of 10, it's still extraordinary.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of other projects, the benefits might be much more similar. So I'm trying to get into how you would make some of these decisions. So I guess, first of all, you need to be able to compare benefits across different types of outcomes. You need a sort of a unit of benefit that you can estimate. What is this? What does it represent?
One caveat that I'll give up front, and I'll try not to repeat in every answer to your questions, is that maximizing impact is a really difficult question, deep, longstanding question, ultimately a philosophical question. And we do not claim to have arrived at a definitive definition. People pursue philanthropic giving for all kinds of reasons, and our prioritization focuses on a subset. But with all that said, we consider two main types of benefits to our grant making. The first is health benefits. So we're trying to prevent premature death and improve morbidity. And the second is economic benefits, or trying to increase consumption, especially for the world's poorest people. We don't think that these two things are the only things that matter in the world or to people, but we think they do capture a lot of what is really important for the global poor, who are a main focus of our work. And so to measure economic benefits, we use a logarithmic model of utility of income, which means that an income doubling is valued equally regardless of the starting point. Or another way of saying that is we treat giving a dollar to someone making $500 a year as 100 times more valuable and giving a dollar to someone making $50,000 a year, but it's $1 in cost in either case. And so this is a very, again, very basic point of economics. Anyone who's taken an undergraduate course will recognize diminishing returns of utility and income. But in our day-to-day work, this motivates us to focus on economic benefits for the global poor.
Now, on the other side of your portfolio, you're talking about health benefits and you estimate and compare those. How do you do that?
Yes. So we measure health benefits. We use a concept called disability adjusted life years, which is often abbreviated DALY or DALY. And that captures both years of life loss. So if someone dies from a given health event, you think about all the years that they were not able to go on to live had they not suffered from that health event. And then it also captures years of healthy life loss due to disability. So morbidity and the pain and suffering that someone incurs if they have a chronic condition.
Disability adjusted life years is a controversial measure because it involves comparing disabilities. Are you using a sort of a least worst measure here? Because any type of comparison of health benefits is open to these similar criticisms.
Yeah, so I've heard a couple people quip that DALYs are the worst form of measuring health benefits, except for all the other ones that have been tried,
which
I agree with. I agree there are many valid criticisms of DALYs. So to give two examples, one is that disability weights don't incorporate the consequences unrelated to the health of the affected individual. So if a child dies of malaria, the DALY burden that's associated with that death doesn't include the pain and suffering that that person's loved ones experience, which is, of course, very important. Mm-hmm. And then a second is that they are usually based on general population surveys that ask people hypothetical questions about, for example, how many years of life they'd give up to avoid having to live with a particular health condition for 10 years. And a criticism is that it's not giving sufficient consideration to the experiences of people who actually do live with those conditions. And I think both of those are really real critiques. That said, DALYs are globally available and consistently estimated across causes of death and risk factors, which is exactly what we need in order to make comparative assessments. It's an enormous task that's conducted by an organization called the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, and they're continually trying to refine their approach.
As I understand it, you don't have a fixed number or a fixed amount of economic and health benefits. So to compare these, there has to be some kind of conversion between these benefits. A lot of people would find this idea of an exchange rate between economic benefits and health benefits to be, well, repugnant.
One initial observation is that if a philanthropy is doing work that is aimed at both health benefits and economic benefits, and it doesn't have an unlimited budget, and it's thus making trade-offs between those two, it is converting between health and economic benefits. Mm-hmm. That conversion may be implicit or unstated, but any actor with a budget is making this trade-off. And so I agree that it's repugnant in the sense that it's repugnant that there's so much suffering in the world and that people are living in conditions of significant material deprivation and dying of diseases that are, in principle, totally preventable. But I don't think trying to be explicit about the trade-off that one is making with limited resources is repugnant. Instead, I hope that it being transparent in this way opens us up to scrutiny. To jump back to the first part of your question, we value averting a year of healthy life loss, so a DALY, as roughly equivalent to multiplying someone's income eightfold for a year, so three income doublings. And that estimate is based on a few different strands of the literature. So to give a few examples, so we looked at studies where people make actual choices between jobs with different wages and health risks, or choices around buying health protecting items. And then we also looked at studies when people answered survey questions asking them to give a stated value of reducing risk to life compared to other values. Maybe just to say aloud, it may seem strange to weigh any additional amount of income against someone's health, but we all make decisions like that every day. So I'm guessing many people listening to the podcast don't own a home security system or haven't taken a CPR class recently. And even though there's a really small chance that either of those things could save your life, you may not think they're worth your time or money. And so just to say, these are choices that we're all making all the time.
After doing this analysis and ranking the potential ways in which you could give grants, you then have to set a bar of which projects are investable, I guess. Where do you set that bar? How do you set that bar?
exactly as you say, the advantage of putting health and economic benefits into a single unit is that we can then calculate a social return of investment for each grant and use that to compare opportunities against one another. And we can also use it to set a bar for impact. And so for us, this is our best guess of our least cost-effective dollar that we'll allocate over time. And so setting that bar involves thinking through intertemporal optimization. So will opportunities get more or less cost-effective as time goes on? And how will that affect our decision to spend versus save for the future? In the past, our bar for impact has been averting a DALI, a disability-adjusted life year, for about $100. Mm-hmm. And now it's closer to averting a DALI for $50. And so that translates overall into a few thousand dollars per life saved.
You're making no secret of the fact that these decisions involve some uncomfortable judgments. I mean, they're both economic judgments and ethical judgments as well. So who in your organization is making these decisions? Who's involved in the process?
Open Philanthropy's setup is we have a research team called the Cause Prioritization Team that recommends which causes we work in and what budgets should be across those causes. And then we hire experts in the specific areas that we work in called program officers, and they recommend grants in any given area. But stepping back from day-to-day decisions, we try to incorporate a broader set of views into our work. So I mentioned DALIs. The disability weights are determined by surveys of the general public. I also mentioned that we try to base our exchange rate of health and economic benefits on our best reading of the literature, which includes input from people demographically similar to the beneficiaries of GiveWell's work and lots of Open Philanthropy's work. We also consult outside experts to get access to a broader range of views. And we ran a program in 2022 where we donated $100 million of global health and well-being funding to other grant makers focused on areas that we thought were promising, but we didn't have expertise in. All that said, I think a very reasonable critique of our approach, and one that I personally think a lot about, is that we don't do enough to incorporate the views of people immediately affected by our work.
So Emily, on Box Dev Talks, a lot of what we cover involves new problem areas, new research, areas where data is scarce or results are speculative. Do you omit those types of interventions in your grant giving?
The ROI framework that we've been talking about is helpful when you have lots of information and you're able to estimate the expected benefits and costs of a given intervention, mm-hmm. come up with an overall cost effectiveness figure, and then compare that to the bar. But most opportunities are not like that. You won't have enough information, or you may not even know in a given problem space what the relevant intervention is. And so to evaluate problems at a high level, we use a framework called INT that we find more helpful.
Okay, what's I, N, N, and T?
The I stands for importance. So how many people does this problem affect and how intensely does it affect them? The N stands for neglectedness. How much attention and funding, especially philanthropically, does this problem receive? And then the T is tractability. Are there clear ways for a philanthropic funder to make progress? And we find that cause areas that are promising along all three dimensions usually end up having many cost-effective specific interventions once you dig deeper and learn more.
If you could score high on all three of those dimensions, and it still might be fairly uncertain whether your grant will be effective, but nevertheless, it is taking funding from something where you know more about what you're going to be able to achieve. When is an intervention important enough then to be able to say, we are going to follow this INT methodology?
We try to capture uncertainty explicitly in our modeling. So we think in expected value terms. So that means that we're willing to pursue an uncertain possibility if the upside is sufficiently large. And so a good example of this is we do a lot of work I mentioned before in global health science. And so we'll think about funding a vaccine candidate, for example, and mm-hmm. there'll be some probability that experts can attribute to the potential success of that candidate in clinical trials. And if we think the potential benefit, if it's successful, the number of lives that it will ultimately save is large enough, then we'll be willing to pursue things that are low probability. I think what we often miss in our framework are potential interventions or problem spaces where the path to impact is really unknown. Mm-hmm. So a good example here is basic science, where it might not be able to trace how a given breakthrough is ultimately going to help people. And it's much harder for us to think about those examples.
Do you have a concrete example of where the INT methodology has paid off?
Yes. So I mentioned this a bit earlier, but one cause area that stands out on INT that we've been spending a lot of time on recently is lead exposure. So I'll quickly run through the case. So on importance, right now, one in two children in low and middle income countries are estimated to be above the WHO's recommended threshold for lead exposure. To give a comparison for listeners, especially in the U.S., in Flint, Michigan, the center of a major scandal on child lead exposure, 1 in 20 children had blood lead levels at that same threshold at the peak of the crisis. Exposure to lead can cause significant harm. It can delay brain and cognitive development, especially for children. It can lead to heart problems and death. So around 1 million people a year die from lead poisoning globally. It's also really neglected. About $15 million of philanthropic and aid agency funding was directed towards lead exposure. One comparison that I find particularly helpful is the ratio of neglectedness to importance. So in other words, how much money is flowing to a given problem per unit of that problem? To apply this to lead, our best guess is that there's about 45 cents of philanthropic spending in reducing lead exposure per disability-adjusted life year lost to lead. And that's two orders of magnitude lower than our estimate of the equivalent figure for malaria and tuberculosis, which are themselves neglected diseases, and at least three orders of magnitude lower than the equivalent estimate for cancer. And so this ratio doesn't tell you anything about how easy or difficult the problem is to address, but it does tell you something about where there might be outsized opportunities. On the third criteria, tractability, we think this issue is quite tractable. So I gave the example of Bangladesh earlier, and there are similar examples of places where we've seen real progress.
Okay, so what you are doing here, though, is controversial. You don't try to hide that at all. Any determination you make involves assumptions, which you are explicit about, but that means that they can be challenged. Where do you get the pushback, the criticism from?
I'll give two categories of pushback. So our work involves, as you say, a mix of quantitative work and then value judgments. And we've heard criticism on both fronts from people who broadly agree with our approach, but end up in different places.
Mm-hmm.
So an example of quantitative criticism is there's fierce debate among economists about the value of preventing schistosomiasis, which is an area that we fund heavily. So some people think it makes a massive difference to someone's future income, while others think it accomplishes almost nothing. And they're arguing over these big studies that can be viewed from multiple angles. On the value side, an example is our work on animal welfare, which I mentioned is part of our global health and well-being portfolio. Mm-hmm. So some people think animal suffering is extremely important to prevent, and other people think it's not worth spending any money on if there are still opportunities to prevent human suffering. And there are many ways to evaluate how much animals matter, but no one way is objectively correct. And then maybe a second category is people who just don't agree at all with our approach.
Yeah.
And there are many flavors of that, but to give one example that I think a lot about is the critique that our model leads us to focus on incremental improvements. It's much harder for us to think about deeper transformational change, but in fact, focusing more on trying to change the overall system is a much more promising approach. And so that's a critique that we hear quite often.
Do you get it wrong? Have you made mistakes?
Yes, definitely. All the time. There are many. To think about some mistakes that keep me up at night, one is that we rely too much on the frameworks above. I've talked through them so far as if they're all that we do, but in reality, they're only a piece of our process. We're ultimately trying to benefit from the discipline that these types of quantification exercises can provide. But at the end of the day, we're making judgment calls and incorporating lots of qualitative evidence. But it's very easy, especially in areas of high uncertainty, to rely too much on what's easily quantifiable. And so I worry a lot about that. Maybe to pick up on the critique I mentioned before, I do worry that we overrate marginal changes and underrate the possibility of transformational change. And so I gave an example earlier of we think a lot about new products and tools that could help address neglected diseases, but we're probably overlooking some areas of basic science with more unknown paths to impact that could make a difference. And then a third one that I'll offer is I'm sure we're missing important information about beneficiary preferences that would change our decision making. So I mentioned the survey that we did on the health income trade-off, but I'd really like to do much more in that area.
Nevertheless, do you think that all grant making should be done this way?
It's a good question, though I don't think of myself as in a position to fully answer it, but let me try to explain how I would approach it. I think philanthropic giving is often a deeply personal decision. So it is for me when my partner and I usually in December decide where to give a portion of our salaries. And it is for people who are giving away much larger sums of money than the two of us. And people are often trying to achieve different goals with different parts of their giving. So I personally have other goals besides maximizing impact that I personally consider when making charitable donations, like supporting and connecting with my local community. But for the majority of the money that I give away, I'm drawn to this type of giving because of the enormous amount of impact that's possible. When you really think through some of the specifics of what it would mean to save a life in expectation for several thousand dollars, it's an incredibly humbling opportunity. And for that reason, I think more people should seriously consider it.
Emily Olsen, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I would imagine that many of you who've been listening to this will have an opinion about it. Let us know if you do, and let us know if you would like to cover this again, because it is fascinating. The paper, if you want to read it, is called Philanthropic Cause Prioritization. The author you just heard from, Emily Olsen. It is in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, 38, number 2. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like Vox Dev Talks, please review us, leave a rating, so more people can hear our episodes.